counsel. This is case number 53250, Scholl v. Veston Realty Mortgage. We have Mr. Edward S. Coleman, counsel for appellate. Mr. Alan Freer is counsel for respondent. Mr. Coleman, you're on.
Mr. Coleman, could I ask you a couple questions just to make sure we got the facts straight here? The note for the loan, was the only maker of that note Brawley California 122 LLC?
Yes.
They were the co-maker. The other parties were just guarantors.
Correct.
And the parties stipulated that California law would apply as far as the foreclosure proceeding itself, and it was foreclosure was done under California Civil Code 2924.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
I don't. First of all, I'm glad to see you. A lot of familiar faces here. Welcome back to Southern Nevada.
Well, we're happy to be back in Southern Nevada, and I hope counsel of both sides appreciate the fact that we've come down and saved you that trip up to rainy Clark, Carson City.
Right. Okay. I want to make what I consider to be a common sense argument rather than go to the details of the briefs, which are set forth in great detail. We've got a couple of pounds of briefs that do hit the key points. But I want to take an overview, if I might. This case involves a security interest in real property. The form of security interest takes the form of a mortgage or a deed of trust. Each of the forms of security are based upon the state law in each state. For example, Nevada allows trustees, deeds of trust, or we call them mortgages, but they're really deeds of trust. In other states, they're called mortgages. In California, they're called deeds of trust as well as in Nevada. Both of these statutory items preempt the common law. And there's an argument by counsel that the common law should prevail. And I think we can just kind of wipe that one off the map because statutes preempt the common law. They change the common law to whatever the state desires. Now, the type of documentation depends upon the state law of a given state. In California, for example, they allow deeds of trust and judicial foreclosures, such as Nevada. In the Midwestern states like Illinois, they have mortgages. They don't allow deeds of trust. The method of foreclosure, that is non-judicial versus judicial, varies from state to state. For example, in Illinois, they require judicial foreclosure. In California, it could be judicial or non-judicial foreclosure, such as a deed of trust, and in Nevada, the same way. The laws vary from state to state. In California, for example, and I happen somehow to have been a California lawyer and still am for some degree, The law in California says that when you give a notice of default, there's 90 days to cure. In Nevada, it's 35 days to cure. In California, there's a 90-day publication period before a foreclosure. In Nevada, a 30-day foreclosure period. In Nevada, it's 35 days notice of default to cure and 90 days roughly for publication. So the procedure, which is also substantive, varies from state to state. In this case, Brawley LLC was a Nevada LLC which owned property in California. Admittedly, the respondent acknowledges that they went through the California procedure. There's a copy of the trustee's deed in the exhibits, in the appendices, which show that the foreclosure occurred under California law because the property was in Imperial County in California. So they followed the California law. And they foreclosed, and under California law, they had 90 days within which to seek a deficiency under California law. In Nevada, if Nevada law were to apply, they had 6 months to seek a deficiency under the Nevada statute. They didn't act under the Nevada statute. They didn't act under the California statute. What they did do, or what they should have done, is to proceed with a deficiency under California law, and Nevada then would give full faith and credit to that deficiency, and then their position would have been accurate and would have been a valid position to take. Instead, they didn't do anything under California law. They allowed the statute of limitations in California to expire. They didn't seek a deficiency under California law. They came in and sought a deficiency under Nevada law, but the Nevada law says you've got to follow NRS 107 in order to get a deficiency. Well, how could they do that when all the foreclosure proceedings were done under California law? The statute created the mortgage or the trust deed under California law. They foreclosed pursuant to the statute under California law. They went through all the process of noticing and actually foreclosing. Now they want to take the California law and say, well, it doesn't matter about a deficiency, when in fact California law provides the means of getting a deficiency.
But couldn't they file a separate lawsuit in Nevada under Nevada law on the guarantee?
Yes.
Independent of the deficiency action.
Right. They filed it on the guarantee, but they sought and the trial court granted them a deficiency. This, we're really talking about the deficiency here.
Well, I have that question for Mr. Furrier. I have her judgment. How do you award a deficiency judgment against guarantors that aren't makers of the note? I mean, I never saw that before, but maybe I'm missing something here, but we'll get to that. But,
well, you know, in theory, I think that they could award a judgment against guarantors if they had gone through the step of seeking a deficiency in California, because the guarantors guaranteed the debt, but in order for the guarantee to have effect, they would have had to seek that deficiency under California law, which is the law that they applied in, number one, getting the deed of trust, number two, in giving notice, number three, in publishing, number four, in having a California trustee sale pursuant to California law, as evidenced by the deed of trust, which is in the appendix, and then failing to follow the same law that created all this mortgage security interest or trustee security interest, and failing to seek the deficiency. So now they're attempting to apply Nevada law in order to obtain that deficiency against the guarantors.
Now, in California, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I know they have anti-deficiency legislation as to certain types of foreclosure.
Only primary residents.
I see. Okay.
Not investment property or anything other. And I think the California statute says something like a primary residence is a residence that is the domicile.
Okay.
And consists of no more than four living units. This was raw land in Imperial County. It was purchased with the idea of investing in building a series of homes. It was acreage in Imperial County. So the anti-deficiency law wouldn't apply in California. It wouldn't apply here in Nevada, because we now have a statute which mirrors the California statute about lack of deficiencies. Now, the method of foreclosure and deficiency we've already talked about. And, you know, just simply, they just didn't follow what they started. And now they want to invoke Nevada law under NRS 107, which we've argued, of course, in our brief, requires that there be certain processes in Nevada. And it says, pursuant to 107. Well, they didn't pursue what was required in 107. They couldn't have pursued. It would be impossible, because 107 just doesn't apply when the property's not in Nevada. Another example, let's assume for the sake of argument that it was the property was in Illinois, where they only allowed judicial foreclosure. Could they come in Nevada and say they followed NRS 107 when, in order to even foreclose in Chicago, Illinois, or any place in Illinois or the Midwest, they'd have to go through a judicial foreclosure? I mean, if they were in Europe, if the property were in England or any other foreign country, they would have had to follow the law of that jurisdiction in order to even foreclose. Why should it be any different? California is a foreign state for all intents and purposes. Illinois is a foreign state. How could they foreclose in Illinois and seek a deficiency without going through judicial foreclosure? And they couldn't do any better in California. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
You have a little over 6 minutes left. Mr. Freer, on behalf of the respondent, you may want to start off by answering Justice Gibbons' question.
Yeah, and Mr. Freer, while you're at it, how can 107080 possibly apply to a California foreclosure?
Right. Let me address the first question. That gets into the common law that we raised in our brief. The guarantors and the guarantee waived their rights properly to proceed under NRS 40430. What that does is it removes the procedural protections that the legislature imposed on the deficiency actions on the previously existing common law authority for the court to enter deficiency judgments. When that procedural protection is released, what that did was allow the court to use its common law jurisdiction to enter a deficiency judgment as to the guarantors. Now, the form of the guarantor...
Well, isn't that waiver? Wasn't that just waiving the one-action rule?
It waives the one-action rule, but also when you get into the one-action rule, you also get into the deficiency procedures of NRS 4, and it was at 453 through 459, as stated in the one-action rule, and I think referenced in the waiver statute.
I thought it my understanding of the law was that you could sue on a guarantee without having to do the foreclosure first if there's a waiver under that issue, but it doesn't mean you don't apply the law of the state where the real property is located.
Right.
As to the foreclosure. You know.
You can waive in terms of beginning the foreclosure action, and that's what occurred here. We started with the suit against the guarantors. After the foreclosure, we added in borrowing party brawl.
How did you get a deficiency judgment against non-makers of the loan?
That's where we get into our brief in terms of with the issue that while the form may be incorrect in terms of the motion, the right to receiving a judgment as a matter of law was proper.
But that you have to try that case under guarantee law. You don't try it under deficiency law as far as the guarantors. That's a contract. If you want to go against a guarantor, you sue for breach of the guarantee under a contract law, and you had a contract theory supply. It's different than deficiency
right.
law.
That was one of the claims that was raised. But in terms of answering the deficiency amount, the deficiency and opposing the deficiency application. The only things they submitted and conceded all of the facts that would have given us rise to summary judgment under the guarantee.
So you're suggesting that just because there was a quasi admission of sorts that we can just sort of do a bait and shift of application of law to two different areas of law?
Yes, when judgment's applicable to both. I mean, just because we stylized the deficiency application as such, the fact that we've got admissions as to the contract, the breach, the liability incurred by that, the amount of value of the property on the date of sale, the ensuing deficiency, if all those facts are consented to, why couldn't the court grant summary judgment as to the guarantees?
Okay.
With respect to the second question, if you could refresh me on what that second question you had was.
I forgot. We get so busy with this one. I was concerned about how you could get the non-makers of the note on a deficiency action. You've answered that. And under California law, but doesn't Mr. Coleman, seems like he has a pretty good point, though. If the parties have agreed to California law would apply on the foreclosure proceeding, which it would have to if the property is located in California, would everything else flow out of that as far as the deficiency proceeding? Wouldn't you have to follow California law on that?
My answer would be no with respect to two reasons. Mm-hmm. First, the parties agreed to have California law apply and the jurisdiction of the California courts or of the Nevada courts to be laid in everything but the deficiency procedure. That is actually contemplated under NRS 40430 because it exempts from the one action rule deficiency or actions to enforce mortgages or deeds of trust located outside of the state. So if you're exempting, you know, by contemplating that the one action rule exempts out-of-state foreclosure actions, you know, to me that is the basis and a reason for why, for Nevada, the legislature believing that deficiency actions can subsequently occur in the state. It's mm-hmm. not something that they would be barred by.
Well, Mr. Freer, I thought about this a lot. I used to do this, as you can gather from my questions as a lawyer, but See, here's my problem. You have the deficient, you have the California foreclosure. It's a trustee's deed recorded in Cal. You bid $1 million for it. They record the deed. That's what triggers the deficiency time period. But the deed's recorded in California, so Mr. Coleman's argument that you'd have to file for a deficiency within 90 days under California, it seems to make some sense to me here, because the whole thing ties to California, not to Nevada.
Right. Well, just to clear up the record, the timing in Nevada occurred within the 6 months, and it would have occurred within the 90 days. It wasn't filed in California, conceivably. But in order to get back to the issue of whether or not NRS 440-455 applies, I believe the interpretation is a little off. If you look at the primary independent clause of that statute, it references that the court shall award a judgment to either a judgment creditor or a beneficiary under a deed of trust. It doesn't reference in that independent clause that it has to be a beneficiary under a deed of trust who foreclosed under 10708.
Yeah, but it says a foreclosure done under NRS 10708-0, which is
right,
Nevada.
But that gets into the timing issue. I mean, the way I would look at it is under the timing issue, the time, the statute of limitations, the limitations period that was to occur, is triggered off of the foreclosure sale under a judgment, judicial foreclosure, or the foreclosure under NRS 10708. And a couple of the points I'd like to make out with respect to that is we've got these issues, you know, basically they don't deny the fact that the parties agreed to these rights or remedies. The substantive law of the anti-deficiency statutes or deficiency legislation is really only twofold. And based on this court's prior law, it might even be less than that. But the two points of substantive law that I would press are, one, to prevent a deficiency that is more than the amount of debt owed. The second one is the timing deadlines, the stepped-up statute of limitations. This court in the Nevis, Lowe, and Vogt cases said if it's not dealing primarily with that deficiency issue, making sure that the creditor doesn't recover more than what he gets, the rest of these statutes are procedural in nature. They're and entitled to a broader interpretation. What I would suggest and what we assert is the foreclosure that occurred in California substantially complied under a broader interpretation of the rights and remedies afforded Nevada residents under 10708-0. For every procedural protection that was afforded under 10708-0, a similar, if not greater, or similar restriction or provision under California law provided them an equal, if not greater, source of protection. So when we get to the end of the day, they were afforded all of the protections 10708-0 would have provided them. The only difference is that the property, as agreed upon by the parties, was located in California. And that's really the only distinction. They don't allege that the foreclosure was improper. They haven't. They haven't challenged the foreclosure. The only thing that they've rested their hat on is that one clause in the second sentence of NRS 4455, pursuant to 10708-0.
But isn't that a threshold requirement in order to get where you're going, is that you have to have done it under the Nevada law?
What we've asserted in our brief is that substantial compliance with 10708-0 would be sufficient. And the reason for that would be the in remedial cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the term pursuant to not be restrictive, but to be inclusive, so long as you basically conform with what is described after the term pursuant to. And we lay that out in our brief. What I would also submit is it's a little incongruous for us to apply a strict definition saying you must comply with NRS 10708-0. You know, you must, that's the only time that you're entitled to a deficiency judgment in Nevada, when in 10708-0, the very procedures that they're relying on to foreclose to prevent us from the recovery.
I guess, and I realize you didn't do the district court proceeding, but I'm baffled procedurally how this was done. I mean, why wouldn't Vestin just sue on the guarantee in Nevada, don't even talk about the deficiency, say there's a breach of the guarantee,
Mr. Coleman could then argue there was an offset on the whatever the fair market value of the property was, and then you go from there. Then you go under guarantee law. This deficiency thing's just a red herring here that has got everybody off track, then, right? Or
I wouldn't concede that we can't get judgment off that, but the deficiency or the guarantee action still was pending. It wasn't dismissed at the time the complaint was amended. So they could still continue to go forward with that guarantee.
Yeah, and we're not going to the validity of the guarantees isn't before us in this appeal.
It was never questioned.
And I'm thinking, again, I'm probably – Mr. Coleman could argue that, you know, they're barred by the statute of limitations. There's theory. I mean, I suppose there's an – I don't know if that applies or not with the waiver clauses, but that's for another day. But so right now we're focusing on the validity of this order entered by the district
right.
court.
If I could make two quick points. One of the distinctions of being required to strictly comply with 107.080 under 455 is a little at odds, because if you read 107.080, the only time that any of those trustee deeds can be set aside is for failure of substantial compliance. So we have a little bit of a clash there, saying, all right, we're going to require strict compliance, means the property has to be located in Nevada. But, you know, if you did proceed and the property was located in Nevada, then you could substantially comply. The other issue I'd like to point out really quick is the only thing that they are objecting to in their brief is that a non-judicial foreclosure occurred in Nevada. They're saying that if a judicial foreclosure occurred outside of Nevada, everything would be hunky-dory, because the way the statute reads, it says judicial foreclosure or foreclosure under deed of trust pursuant to NRS 107.080. Based on the statutory interpretation and the policies of this, making such a distinction is really...
Well, you could pursue a deficiency under NRS 107.080, whether it's judicial or non-judicial. I mean, that's the law. The question is, does California law apply here in this situation? Right. I understand Mr. Coleman's. I don't agree with that argument, but I'll give him a chance to
right.
comment.
Right, but we make a distinction. You know, the other side makes a distinction that 455 only bars non-judicial foreclosures occurring outside the state. The legislature never intended to create a loophole like that, where it would allow judicial foreclosures occurring outside of the state, but barring non-judicial foreclosures outside of the state. Because what the legislature intended, and as this court recognized, is the deficiency statutes are a procedure that are fair to all, that are entitled a lender to receive the benefit of the debt due and owing. And I thought my time was up, so I was trying to hurry through.
You have 2 minutes and 30 seconds left.
Okay. And let's get into that policy just a little bit. You know, to me, this case, if you read a strict construction of NRS 4455, arguably you would end up in a result where non-judicial foreclosures on deeds of trust located outside of the state are barred. I would liken that arbitrary distinction between judicial and non-judicial foreclosures on extraterritorial property to the decision that the court reached in the Lomax, where it analyzed the waiver statute and said the Nevada legislature couldn't have intended that all waivers in NRS Chapter 40 meant all waivers, such as waivers to jury trials and everything. What the court did was it adopted a reasonable approach, recognizing that the Nevada legislature couldn't have intended that. And when you get into the legislative minutes that we've discussed and cited in our brief, you'll find that the Nevada legislature only was concerned about limiting the amount of the deficiency and providing some time period. They actually considered and rejected legislation that would have eliminated deficiency judgments. So taken with that, and also the NRS 4430, which treats judicial, non-judicial foreclosures on the same footing, we would submit that trying to distinguish between a judicial, non-judicial foreclosure outside of the state just because of a reference to pursuant to the phrase pursuant to NRS 107.080 is arbitrary, and the court should use a reasonable approach and find that if the protections afforded under 107.080 are met, that the lender has satisfied that requirement and is entitled to seek a deficiency judgment as agreed upon and contemplated by the parties. Thank you.
Coleman, you have 6 minutes and 8 seconds left.
I have to submit that counsel's argument is absolutely ridiculous in as much as what he's saying to the court is that 107 is supposed to incorporate California law because it's the same. We're similar. It's not the same because there are different requirements to invoke the California deficiency judgment. The timing, the seeking of a deficiency within 90 days versus 6 months in Nevada, the notice provisions, it's different. It's totally different. And under Nevada law, in the cases that the Supreme Court has held, say you can't, and the statute says that you can't waive Section 40.455 et sec. You can't waive it. There is no waiver of that. The law clearly states that. I want to point out some items in the loan documents, as cited by the respondent. There is on page 4, lines 11 of their brief, the loan, action proceeding arising out of or relating to the note and loan agreement, and then parenthesis, except the power of sale provision of deed of trust, which shall be referred to as power of sale matters. So they accept in their own documentation the power of sale, and therefore when they exempt the power of sale, they're really saying California law applies. Likewise, on line 17 and 18, the same page, each of the guarantor and lender irrevocably and unconditionally waives to the full extent it may legally and effectively do so, which you can't do under Nevada law, you can't waive it, any objections it may now or hereafter have to the laying of jurisdiction or venue of any suit arising out of the guarantee in Nevada. Well, you can't waive it under Nevada. Well,
guarantors can waive, can't they? Is it 40.695, something like that? It's in that chapter. I think they can waive certain requirements.
I don't think so. I think the statute says you're not allowed to waive it. The legislature.
The maker can't waive. It's a public policy issue, but I think it's a different rule for guarantors, if I remember correctly.
But isn't the guarantor's liability dependent upon the principal's liability? And if the principal's liability is such where it can't waive, then the guarantor stands behind the principal because the principal can have no greater rights, nor the guarantors, and greater rights than the principal. And so they're subject to the same liability as the principal. So if the principal can't waive it, then the guarantor can stand behind the principal and say, the principal didn't waive it, so therefore we're not liable. At least that's my interpretation. Line 23 in the same page, the loan documents say, other than power of sale matters, they accept all of the California related non-judicial foreclosure proceedings. They go on in the agreement on page 5 of their own brief. There's a material inducement to vest a mortgage to enter into the agreement, which opine the Nevada law applied except as to foreclosure proceedings for which California law applied. They recognize the fact that the California law has to be applied. In their own brief, once again, on page 6, they say, during the pendency of the complaint, Vestin completed a non-judicial foreclosure of security in California pursuant to the power of sale contained in the deed of trust. Neither Brawling nor the guarantors challenged the foreclosure sale. The foreclosure sale was conducted in compliance with California law. We acknowledge that. Well, if they're saying they acknowledge it, if they acknowledge it, then therefore the California procedure has to apply. And they go on to say that it cannot be disputed that the trustee sale property was conducted in accordance with and under the authority of California law, and so on. All throughout the briefing, they acknowledge the California law must apply. Now, we also provide in our briefs that There's cases in California, including the Nevis case cited by counsel, that NRS 40.455 has substantive aspects. As such, the lender's characterization of the statute as procedural and or remedial to support its argument should be broadly interpreted is absolutely without merit because it is specific and it is intended to be restrictive that the foreclosure under 107 has to be done pursuant to Nevada law. It says pursuant. We've gone through a lot of dialogue here, or a monologue maybe, about what pursuant means. Pursuant means as the statute requires. It's a simple interpretation. Well, it couldn't have been done because under Nevada law, there has to be an application, which incidentally is defined in the NRS as a motion versus a lawsuit. It's a motion. An application is a motion. Mm-hmm. They have to seek a motion under Nevada law under 107. The court then appoints an appraiser. The appraiser then comes before the court, and there's testimony, and the appraiser's appraisal can be contested. None of that was done here. It was never done because it couldn't have been done. Under the Nevada law, there could not have been a proceeding under 107 because there was no appraiser appointed, there was no action for that purpose. They just simply went ahead and said, and they didn't specify in their pleadings, that this was a foreclosure in Nevada law. I just said it was foreclosed. But they didn't say under California law. They tried to adopt the California law as Nevada law, and that's just not the way the system works.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Furr, and thank you, Mr. Coleman, for your fine arguments and briefs in this matter. This case will stand submitted.